The scripture for this morning that Rochelle asked to kind of make a centerpiece of things she will be sharing, not the only thing, is from Colossians chapter 1, verses 15 to 20. It was written at least in the Jerusalem Bible, which I'm reading from, in the form of a poem. I think in a lot of versions it's just written out as if it's declarative, as prose, but part of the thinking is it was written as a poem. Speaking of Jesus, he is the image of the unseen God and the firstborn of all creation. For in him were created all things in heaven and on earth. Everything visible and everything invisible. Thrones, dominions, sovereignties, powers, all things were created through him and for him. Before anything was created, he existed, and he holds all things in unity. Now the church is his body. He is its head. As he is the beginning, he was first to be born from the dead, so that he should be first in every way. Because God wanted all perfection to be found in him, and all things to be reconciled through him and for him, everything in heaven and everything on earth. When he made peace by his death on the cross. Good poem. I guess there will not be a children's story this morning. So we will proceed, and Rochelle will be sharing with us. And what I do know from a personal standpoint is that Rachel, my Rachel and her, were at Goshen College at the same time. So my daughter speaks highly of her. Therefore, I think highly of her, and I've only said a few words to her. But I am very thankful she's here, Rochelle.
Thank you. It's too bad that it worked out that the Sunday that I was able to come is a Sunday when Rachel is not here. But in any case, I'm delighted to be with you this morning and for the invitation to join and share some words with you. I thought that since it's a smaller group, Rachel said it's summertime, maybe it could be more discussion and less of a sermon. So I don't have a formal sermon prepared, whether that's good news or bad news for you, I'm not sure. But I thought I'd just share some reflections, and then I think we'll spend a little bit of time as well doing a little bit of Bible study with a couple of texts related to the government. So let me introduce myself a little bit more first. My name's Rochelle Lindaker-Schlaubach. I am the director of Mennonite Central Committee's office in Washington, D.C. As I told a few of you beforehand, as we were talking informally, I'm from Holmes County, Ohio, originally. I grew up in probably one of the least political families that I know, in a church that never talked politics, at least in any outward sense. And I would have never envisioned at that point in time that I would end up in the Washington office, and certainly that I would still be there 20 plus years later. So God has a sense of humor, as I like to say. At Goshen College is where I began to get involved in the Peace Club, started writing some letters to members of Congress, and then was particularly compelled on a trip to Guatemala as part of my studies at Goshen with the degree to which Guatemalans knew about U.S. foreign policy in ways that I, as a U.S. citizen, did not. And of course, it was at that point in time, this was the mid to late 90s, the U.S. was not that far removed from involvement in the Civil War there. And so it challenged me as a Christian to know more about what my government was doing and to be able to be a better advocate for different kinds of policies. And so that is how I originally ended up in the Washington office. Stayed for 5 years, then I went off to seminary, thought pastoral ministry was more where I was going, had a brief connection with Carla during that time, doing the ministry inquiry program out in Colorado. That was actually undergrad, not in seminary. After seminary, then I actually came back to the Washington office, and that's where I've been since 2007 as the director. But I like to come back to Ohio to see family and, of course, to connect with others as well. So it's great to be here. So I talked a little bit about Guatemala and how that impacted my understanding of our government's role. And really, it's in that kind of way that MCC started the Washington office originally. Any of you know when the Washington office? How many of you, before you knew I was coming, knew that MCC had a Washington office? Maybe I should start with that. Yes, Delbert France. So Dalton France, yes, was the founder of the office. 1968 was the year that it started. MCC is actually coming up on our 100th year. Our centennial is next year, 2020. So it was about 50 years into MCC's existence that MCC took the controversial step of opening up an office in Washington. And it was really in large part because of MCC's involvement in places like Vietnam, where, of course, at that point the war was raging, and the Vietnamese people were telling the MCC workers, "We appreciate what you have done for us here, but it's as if..." One of them used an image, "It's as if you're at the bottom of a waterfall with a bucket trying to stop the waterfall from happening." He said, "You need to go back to your country and stop the waterfall in the first place." So in other words, rather than only responding with the relief assistance that MCC was trying to provide to stop those root causes, why are people suffering in the first place? And that is not always related to government policies, but often it is, including sometimes our own government's policies, whether we're talking about, you know, poverty or war and conflict impacting people in this country, but also around the world. We have to take a look at our government's policies and whether they are helping or hurting, and sometimes they're doing both. And so that's part of what we try to take a look at in our office. So we have a staff of 5, full-time staff, and often a couple of interns as well. If any of you younger people might have interest at some point in an internship, you can keep our office in mind. We work on a variety of both foreign policy and domestic policy issues. So on the foreign policy side, that includes things like the Middle East, which is what I focus on. It also includes North Korea, Democratic Republic of the Congo. Within Latin America, our main focus is looking at migration within Central America and Mexico, which connects directly to one of our top domestic priorities, which is immigration. We also, on the domestic side, work on criminal justice reforms, also some gun policy, and then some environmental issues as well. So that's, in brief, the kinds of issues that we work on, which really grow out of MCC's work here in the US, where, I don't know if you're aware, but MCC actually provides, for example, documentation services for immigrants, and that's part of why immigration is a high priority for our office in Washington. And similarly, around the world, as we survey our staff and the organizations that we work with in these different countries, those are some of the policy priorities that have emerged for our office. So how do we do our work? About half of our time is more the direct advocacy. Some people use the word lobbying. I don't like the word lobbying. I feel like it implies that we're putting money into the system through donations, and we definitely are not. We have moral suasion, no financial suasion at all over candidates or positions of elected officials. But we like to call it advocacy. So we do lots of direct meetings with congressional offices in an average week, I'm meeting with at least a few offices about some issue. We also connect with administration officials as well, mostly at the State Department, because a lot of our work is on foreign policy, but sometimes also justice or homeland security or other administration departments in Washington. We work in coalition with lots of other organizations, so lots of other faith-based groups, lots of denominations and organizations have an office in Washington, and we work closely with many of them. For example, there's an interfaith immigration coalition that one of our staff helped to chair for many years, and it has, I think it's currently 50 or 60 faith-based organizations that are part of that. So that provides a real strength of message and voice as we go to government officials and say it's not just MCC saying this, it's a broader voice that feels this way. But then we also, the other half of our work is engaging folks like you to contact your members of Congress and to help you stay informed and aware about these different issues. So that includes things like speaking in various places, but we also write articles, we send out action alerts, we try to make things as easy as possible. We have usually a little sample text that you can change however you like and then just click send, and if you've put in your zip code or address, then it'll send it to the right members of Congress. So we have those lists. I'll put out a sign-up sheet later. We also have other ways of engaging. We have a monthly electronic newsletter called the eMemo and also a print newsletter called the Washington Memo. I'll have some copies of those available as well. All of it's free and just available to help you stay aware of these issues and what MCC's take on it is and how you might be able to get involved and contact Congress. I also have some handouts giving pointers on, you know, how to contact Congress or set up a meeting or that kind of thing. So feel free to take that or to ask me any questions about it as well. So I thought that's a little bit about the office in general. And how MCC, from a program standpoint, got involved in doing advocacy. But there's also this rich biblical history of advocacy and also a complicated narrative within Scripture in terms of how do we see government authorities. And I think for some Anabaptists or Mennonites, we've understood there to be one right way to see that. And even within early Anabaptism, there's actually multiple views in terms of how to view the state. And all of them with some scriptural basis, I must say, as many different denominations have also come out at different places in terms of how to relate to the state. So if you'll bear with me here, if you're all up for being a little more interactive, I'm going to break you maybe into like three groups, just kind of cluster with people near you. I'll give you a scripture and then we'll do a little quick discussion. Oh, I have text printed off, but if you'd rather have Bibles, that's fine too. I think these are all NRSV. I don't know if you all care which version of scripture you use, but all right, so over here, I think. I'm going to give maybe from here on over. Does that work? This is a Matthew text, the Gospel of Matthew. I'll give you all back there one from 1 Samuel, and over here you get Romans 13. So you can pass out the sheets, take a few minutes to just read through the text there first, either have one of you read aloud or you can read quietly to yourself, whatever you prefer. And then think about the question and discuss with one another, what does this text tell me about how to relate to the state or to government authorities? Okay? What does this text tell me about how to relate to the state? So the question for discussion is, what does this text tell us about how to relate to the state or to government, whatever word you want to use? Just about another minute or two, and then we'll wrap up this part. Okay, you can go ahead and conclude whatever thought or sentence you're currently on. If you haven't resolved things, don't worry. Some of these do not get easily resolved, I think. This is part of what I love about the scripture. It's something to wrestle with. It's not always just an easy message for us, is it? All right, let's start in the order that they appear in scripture for us. So let's go first to the First Samuel group. Does one of you want to give maybe just like a sentence or two summary of the text? And then if you have any key insights that your group were sharing with one another. Indeed. He will conscript your young men. He will force you to pay taxes, et cetera, et cetera. Yes. Okay. And what did you have to say about that? Yeah, and of course, this is in the context of what would become a theocracy, right? So it was religion and state together for the people of Israel, eventually Judah as well. As we look at King David and the whole line of kings, I could have given you lots of scriptures, so I'll just fill in a few other things that come up as we move through the Hebrew scriptures, the Old Testament. Of course, some of those kings did right in the eyes of the Lord, according to scripture, and many of them did not. And for all of them, it was at least a bit of a mixed record, right? And then you have this whole prophetic tradition of the Hebrew prophets speaking, yes, to the kings of Israel and Judah, but also speaking, interestingly enough, in what's called oracles to the nations around them too. So even nations that did not proclaim any faith in Yahweh God still got a message from the prophets about how they were to treat their people, what was to be considered just. And so it's clear throughout scripture that God cares about how governments are set up, whether it is a theocracy kind of situation or whether it's not. So let's continue on then into the New Testament. Let's come on over to the Gospel of Matthew. One of you want to say briefly what the text is about?
Well, the Pharisees want to trap Jesus, and they're plotting already. They're plotting to do away with him. So they come up with a great question, which he's got to come down in on one position or another. And they can either get him with breaking Roman law, or they can get him with breaking religious Jewish law. And Jesus confounds them by saying, what belongs to Caesar, give to Caesar. What belongs to God, give to God. So he doesn't answer the question the way that they want to answer.
So how did you work on discussing that then? Did Jesus confound you as well?
Pretty much. He often has a habit of doing that.
He does.
But he put it back on them. Passed it back. They didn't want to answer it either, so he just walked away. But it also is the question that we continually wrestle with. What's God's? What is Caesar's?
So it appears that there's a proper role for each, but exactly how to determine that is something that we as followers of Jesus continue to work out today, right?
And then, of course, I guess there's the problem when these two separate things get into the mix or intersect.
They are often not as separate as we think they are. Yes. As I like to say, there's never a dull day in my work. Yeah. But it's not just people in our office who have to wrestle with this. I mean, all of us, right? As we even just exist, we engage, whether we want to or not, in things that have political implications. And how do we understand that as Christians? All right, let's come on over to Romans 13. First, a brief summary. So in addition to noting the context and that it was written in the midst of the empire, any other reflections that your group had on that? Yeah, and overall, I think it's one of the more positive images that we get in Scripture of government being instituted in order to provide order in the midst of what could be chaos. It was helpful for me, as one who has struggled with aspects of this passage over the years, to hear a Colombian Mennonite leader describe how important that concept is to him, because in his country he has experienced chaos in the midst of civil war, which fortunately now is a bit past, hopefully, but at that point in time they were still in the midst of war, and he said government needs to provide order and structure. That's a key role, and we shouldn't skip over it in Scripture. Those of us in the U.S. maybe have the luxury of saying, forget that part, but it is an important role. But the passage, of course, also implies government will punish wrongdoers and will honor those who are doing good, and I think for many of us, as we've been aware of various governments over the years, whether it's this country or around the world, government doesn't always operate that way, right? So sometimes it works that way, sometimes it doesn't. And in Scripture, we also get other of that more negative view, too. I had to pick just a few passages, but, you know, Romans 13 is sometimes contrasted with Revelation 13, which is talking about Babylon, which is, of course, again, the Roman Empire, and talking about how it has overstepped its bounds and how it will fall as a result. And so we have all of that there within Scripture. And so I'm not here to resolve all that nicely for you, but I decided to go with Colossians as the text that would be read, in part because for me, this is one that was never, I didn't hear it emphasized growing up, but it's actually pretty fundamental that Jesus is Lord over all creation. Like, no matter what happens in terms of government structures, whether they are upholding just policies, whether they are carrying out terrible policies, they are subject in the end to God, and in that I find great hope. I don't know when or how exactly all of that will happen, but it's pretty clear here. This is sweeping language that we see in Colossians, whether thrones or dominions or rulers or powers, however you understand each of those concepts, and there are different ways I think that we can understand them, but I think it includes human authorities, certainly. All things have been created through him and for him. And in the end, you know, it's building up towards, through him, through Christ, God was pleased to reconcile to himself all things. So we have this vision in the New Testament that all things will be somehow reconciled and made right. And so that is part of what I cling to in my work. One of you asked earlier before the service started, what was the question, whether I lose hope or something. These are the kinds of things that ground me, that I cling to on a daily basis, because for me it is fundamental that even these structures that seem so powerful are indeed subject to Christ, and that's deeply rooted in my faith. So I'm not sure how much more time we have. I'm happy to take questions now or afterwards, but I also want to be mindful of your time. So
we would have time now.
Okay.
If I have a specific question.
Or can be comments too, I should say. It doesn't have to just be questions. Yeah. Yeah, thank you. And that reminds me, I actually skipped over One thing that I was also going to mention, which is that we do have a long history within Scripture, whether it's individuals or the people of God, calling for different policies. So I mentioned the Hebrew prophets, but of course you've also got Esther going to the king. You've got even Moses going to Pharaoh saying, "Let my people go," right? You've got all of these different examples. If you look at the New Testament, you've got John the Baptist confronting Herod and literally losing his head as a result. And so, I mean, we do have these examples before us of people of faith being called to confront government about policies. And for me, that does provide a solid history to stand on, that it's not just me saying, well, I think this should work. At the same time, I'm strongly committed to separation of church and state. I don't think that the church should be calling on the government to become, you know, Christendom, right? That I'm not advocating that America be a Christian nation. But I do think, you know, we can glean some wisdom from scriptures in terms of what is important to God. I looked at Psalm 72 a couple of weeks ago in my church, which is one of the royal psalms, and it talks about how just rulers or kings will care for the poor in their society, and they will try to ensure that prosperity benefits everyone and not just, you know, benefit from their own position, right? I mean, we've seen kings and government officials often try to benefit personally. So there are these kinds of things that we can, as a church, call on government to uphold and say, no, there is a different way. Are you caring for the common good? Are you looking out for the well-being of all? And so to me, that is a fundamental part of our calling as Christians. It's certainly not all that we should be doing as Christians, but it is one piece of our Christian walk. I don't know if that responds to what you're saying. That's a good question. I try to figure that out every day. I mean, for me, it's important fundamentally that I be faithful. So rather than saying, you know, I'm going to use any methods possible to get change to happen, I do feel like it's important the way that I go into a congressional office, the way I carry myself. I want them to know they're talking to someone who follows Jesus. I'm not in there cussing them out or, you know, whatever. I'm handling myself in a way that hopefully shows Christ to them, just even in how I live and talk. And I do think even for us as a church, it's also really important that our witness to government has integrity in how we live our lives. So I don't want to be going in and talking about how to address poverty on a governmental level if my local congregation is doing nothing to address poverty in our neighborhood in DC. It's the lived reality of our church life that I think gives our witness credibility and power when we then go to government and say, you know, this works. There is a different way of doing things. And we can care for those on the margins of society. And this is what it looks like in our community. And so I certainly think that's part of it as well, is making sure that our lives are reflecting what it is that we're maybe asking government to reflect. Yeah.
Given that there's a lot of Christian rhetoric and beliefs, some different perspectives in government, do those conversations ever come up with staffers on the Hill or the bosses?
You mean, do they use Christian language themselves? It depends on the office, certainly. Most of my meetings are more with the staff level and not the member of Congress. But yeah, certainly some of them do reference their Christian faith and how important it is to them.
Is there a typical direction that that goes? Is there a sense of agreement or a sense of...
It's all over the map, yeah. I mean, I think because there is such a variety of ways of understanding Christianity, you know, some members of Congress might espouse faith that seems very similar to yours. Others might say, because I'm a Christian, I believe this. It might seem quite different. So that definitely happens. But I do feel like it is a common ground. Or, you know, sometimes they'll even try to find other connections. Like they'll say, oh, you're a peace church. My mother was a Quaker or something. You know, they'll come up with all sorts of interesting connections, even if they don't claim to be Quaker themselves or whatever. So, I mean, that's certainly, it's something that I draw on in terms of how to relate to them if I know that their faith is important to them. But it doesn't mean, of course, that we see things exactly the same. Yeah, maybe we'll go to you again and then over here. Yeah. Or to you first. Okay.
I was going to ask you how, what you feel supported or disappointed by how you feel backed by the church in this country when you live in the office and you, as you say, the trend, the presence in there.
Mm-hmm. Again, I think it varies. I think overall, church members could be much more active in contacting Congress than they are. I think you shouldn't underestimate how powerful that voice is, actually. The fact that most people just simply don't take the time to do it means that they're only hearing from a small percentage of their constituents. So I definitely have gone into offices where they say, you know, it's nice to hear what your perspective is as a national representative, but we're not hearing from the people in the pews in our district. And that's a challenge to me to ensure that they are hearing more from the people in the pews, so to speak. But I also can think of other examples where, you know, back when, this was back during the Obama years when he was first looking at airstrikes in Syria, which seems like a long time ago now that the U.S. has been militarily involved in Syria. But at that point in time, it was seen as kind of this big moment. I don't know if you remember that. I think it was 2016. And I went into some offices to talk about what we were hearing from our partner organizations within Syria, which they were very keen to hear. And the staffers would say, oh my goodness, our phones are ringing off the hook. We're hearing from literally thousands of our constituents on this issue. And I could look and see, maybe I shouldn't tell you this, but when we send out an action alert, I can track how many people respond. And I could see that, you know, we were generating, you know, just as MCC, I forget what the number was, but in the thousands of calls on that particular issue at that moment in time. And of course, other organizations were working on it too. It wasn't just us who was trying to generate calls. So there are times when I have gone in and I've felt like, oh, the church is speaking out on these things. And sometimes we hear that with immigration too, in terms of the numbers of calls coming in. But yeah, go ahead.
I just wanted to say that I really do appreciate the work that you're doing. Somehow, I guess I'm on a mailing list for your different policies mm-hmm. and that kind of thing. And this week, particularly, just with the shootings and all, I got the information as far as how to respond to gun violence. And it is really true. There's a whole statement, and you can just click on it, and then it you know, it just had our senators like Brown and Portman and representative. I mean, you can click on this statement already and you can add if you want to and just click and it's automatically sent to mm-hmm. them. And I just appreciate that. You know, sometimes you don't know where to start, and I think that's just a really good starting place. Mm-hmm.
Thank you for taking time to do that. Yeah.
Along those lines, mm-hmm. do you find it more effective if you hear that it's more effective, whether it's phone call, paper letter, email, is there a generic, you know, click on something? Is there one that's taken, one form that's taken more seriously?
I would discourage paper letters at this point because anthrax meant that all mail to congressional offices gets routed to a different post office, gets processed. It takes literally weeks to get there. That still happens, even though we haven't had an anthrax attack in a while, but it takes a long time for paper letters to get through. Email and phone call I would see as both about equally good. With emails, I would definitely, if you can, take the time to personalize it a little bit. You know, they get a lot of emails, and they can see if they're all starting to come in and say the exact same thing, you know, that there's organizations like us behind those. But if you take some time to personalize it a bit, I mean, you can stick with maybe the ask if you agree with it. I mean, you can also change it if you if you get our email and you think, oh, MCC, totally disagree with that. You can change it and make it say whatever you want. But, you know, it's great if you can take a few moments to personalize it. Why is this important to me? And even if you can broaden that out and say, why is it important to this church or to this town or community? Those are the kinds of things that really get the attention of a member of Congress, actually. So if you can personalize it, that's great. And then, of course, the most effective is, you know, an in-person meeting, if you can do that. And it's not, it doesn't mean you have to go to D.C. to do it. They, you know, all members have in district offices, whether it's the Senate or House district. So it's more doable than you think. So, yeah.
Mm-hmm. You mentioned this bombing in Syria. Can you explain that a little more? You mentioned hearing from partners. Who are the partners, and what were they expressing to you that caused you to have a point of view, or in whether you can relate any other incidents or that? Just fill us in a bit.
Ah, yes. I do have a print newsletter issue on Syria if you're interested in reading more. We have, so MCC has worked in Syria for about 30 years now, so we have a history that predates the war there. We have worked mostly with churches, but also with a few other organizations in Syria. The churches are mostly in government-held areas, not in opposition-held areas of Syria, so that does impact, of course, what they're seeing and telling us, so we keep that in mind as we, you know, look at the news and what others are saying as well within Syria. At that point in time, the U.S. was involved in a covert way in Syria, but not with outward airstrikes. This was, well, yeah, they hadn't actually started the ISIS attacks at that point. And what we have heard really since the beginning of the war from our partners in Syria is that the war is terrible, it's tearing apart communities that for decades lived together, and that they want, as Syrians, to be able to work out a peaceful future for their country. So they want support for the negotiations that are happening on a couple of different tracks. They want support for, you know, from the U.S. for forming a constitutional committee to come up with a new constitution for the country, that kind of thing, but written by Syrians for Syrians. They don't want the U.S. military involved. They also don't want the Russian military, the Iranian military. They don't want any foreign military involvement, and so they've been quite consistent with that over the years. And certainly at that point in time, we were hearing that, and we were hearing that, you know, people in communities that were expecting the airstrikes were fleeing and that kind of thing. So those were the kinds of reports that we were bringing to congressional offices. So that's in brief. We can talk more later. Syria is very complicated. Yes.
You were talking about immigration, and I know this is, it's the hardest thing to understand. And after hearing this week of the raid that they had, I can't remember what state, it was Missouri, Mississippi, and hearing these children that were left behind, and having this happen in our own church, and to see that with the government, I mean, it's not going anywhere. It's, you know, from when it happened with us and when it's happening now, it's like, I don't see anything being resolved. And it's like, you know, we can talk, and, you know, we've got families that are, you know, hiding, they're being saved in the churches, and, you know, there's more and more. And I don't know, you know, how this is going to be resolved. And it's like an unanswered prayer. you know, and what can we keep doing? How can we, you know, help, you know, all these children that were left behind without their parents again, you know, and it's going to continue. And, you know, what do we do to help? And it's like, you feel so helpless, even though, you know, we've tried so many things.
Yeah, it is a huge issue, and I understand the feeling of frustration. And we have, as I'm sure you know, gotten to the point of getting immigration reform through one chamber, but not the other chamber. That's happened a couple of times now, and it's been a while since the most recent one. I mean, it's clear that we need to do an overhaul of our immigration system. It's broken. It's not working in multiple ways. It's certainly not working for immigrants. It's also not working for businesses. It's not working for our many communities in many ways. What is lacking is the political will to force that change from happening, you know, even, and it's not a party issue, honestly. Like, Obama deported a lot of immigrants. It was quieter, it didn't make the news as much. We were very critical of his immigration policies. What we've seen under President Trump is that those deportations have continued and increased, but it certainly wasn't a new thing under President Trump. And so these issues have been there for a long time and they need to be addressed. And what we need is politicians in both parties to hear strongly from you all as voters, as their constituents. We want to see a change and we want to see humane and just immigration policies that work for our communities. And until we get to that point, we're just going to keep trying to address these short-term symptoms. I mean, like, you can put up a wall on the border, but if you're not looking at why people are leaving their homes, and how do we help create conditions where people can stay with dignity in their homes so they don't feel like they have to come to the U.S. to earn a living or to get safety from violence, whatever their reason is for coming. You know, how can we look at that whole picture? And, you know, so one of the responses from the current administration has been to cut off assistance to Central American countries. Well, I mean, we're critical of certain kinds of assistance, certainly the military assistance we critique, but if you're cutting off poverty-related assistance or, you know, all of these different kinds of programs, that's making it even more difficult for people to stay in their homes. And these are, you know, gut-wrenching decisions people have to make to leave their homes and to come. And so, yeah, it is a big, complicated set of issues. And we try to look at that whole picture and not just at one piece of it. But it has been really hard. And even the piecemeal, you know, it's been hard to get even small immigration-related bills through Congress.
I understand what you're saying, you know, that you're being able to survive.
Yeah, and I would encourage you to find those different connecting points. You know, your members of Congress may be all over the map on this issue. But, you know, I've found, you know, in a conservative Republican office that maybe isn't interested in discussing the DACA program, for example, if you start talking about MCC's programs in Central America to help people stay in their homes, suddenly, you know, their whole demeanor changes and they're like, oh, well, that's interesting. How does that work? Tell us more. And so, you know, how can you find those connecting points? And that's, of course, not all of it, right? Some people will still need to leave for various reasons, but that's part of it. And how can we find those connecting points with our politicians, wherever they may be on these issues? I can talk forever, so cut me off whenever I need to.
Talking about, when it does stop complaining and do something about it. That's my opinion.
You better get on the phone tomorrow and let them know you're
there. Yeah. That's like she said, you have to be contacting her. And he's been a part of that also because he's a part of a lot of advocacy groups. And we have, went to the state and talked to a lot of, the senators and some of the, some of the people in the state offices on different disability issues and stuff. So he has, voiced his opinions and done that before in the state. So.
Oh, that's great. And that is a really good reminder, too. Our office focuses on the federal level, but there is so much at the local and state level that makes a real difference in people's lives. So don't underestimate the importance of reaching out to those officials as well. Yeah.
Do you think the reason that the churches haven't stepped up to force humane immigration policy is because we can't agree on what the definition of humane is, because some people would say humane is completely open borders, while others would say at least a system that can be understood and really does address the needs of the people that need to come to leave their country and come here, maybe?
It's a good question. I think there are a lot of reasons why we haven't been able to achieve immigration reforms. And I do think overall, at least the official voices of churches have been quite united in what they have been calling for. I also don't see it as necessarily bad that you have various positions out there, because at the end of the day, it's the job of members of Congress to take all of that into account. And if they're hearing voices on each end, maybe they will come up with something somewhere towards the middle that is a compromise of those different positions. So I don't think we have to have only one voice that's going towards Congress even. Although having said that, a lot of churches have laid out what they see as important for immigration reforms to happen. There's been some disagreement as to whether to try to get that in a piecemeal way, one step at a time, or whether to go for it all at once. There's been different ways of approaching it over the years. None of them have worked, honestly. It's just a tough political environment. When you talk with members of Congress on this issue, it's clear that they are getting a lot of very anti-immigrant calls from constituents in their districts, and that is true in many different districts. It's not just like a handful of members of Congress that would say that. And so whatever we think is a more humane policy, how can we at least provide that voice that does allow some dignity and humanity into the conversation, whatever that results in terms of policies. That's one thing we hear a lot, actually, from migrants themselves and from organizations that work with them. In Mexico, for example, they say one of the things that they're seeing is just the absolute dehumanization of migrants, that they're not seen as people. And so we try to tell their stories and give them faces and remind people they are human beings. It's challenging to figure out the paperwork side of things, the documentation side, but they're people with a story, and how can we relate to them in a humane way? Yeah. Say a little more. You're wondering whether the government. Yeah. I mean, certainly it's hard to make sweeping statements, and you can always find people who back up your point of view, whatever stance you have. Yeah. I can try to respond. I'm not sure if it's what you're getting at. I mean, we definitely see the administration taking certain things, like, for example, if an undocumented immigrant commits a crime, a violent crime in particular, you know, suddenly that'll get lots of attention in news media, and there's been congressional hearings, you know, featuring the victims of those crimes and that kind of thing. Whereas if you look at the overall statistics, you know, the chance of a crime being committed by a native-born American is much higher than a crime being committed by an undocumented immigrant. So, I think you're asking even the opposite side. Is it possible that maybe groups are taking stories of immigrants who are experiencing hard conditions and maybe blowing them out of proportion? And I mean, I think that's something that groups always need to be aware of. Is this an isolated incident, or is this evidence of a systemic pattern of how people are being treated? I think, you know, currently the conditions along the border are very difficult, and the ICE is being overwhelmed with the numbers of immigrants who are coming, and they are being put into detention centers, many of them, not all of them, some are released into communities with court dates and that kind of thing, but many are held in those kinds of conditions. And so, you know, how do we recognize how complex it is? The immigration system is huge. I mean, there are more, I think I have this right, more immigration enforcement officers than all other federal law enforcement combined, if I remember correctly. Like, it's a big part of our government structure. But yeah, how do you take all of that complexity and say, well, it's not just happening in these individual cases, it is happening more broadly. So that's where, you know, from our perspective, both stories and humanizing people, as well as looking at statistics and the overall reality, is important, holding those things together, because you can always find an individual story that's gonna make one point or another. But does it align with what many others are also experiencing? And so when you have both of those things together, I think that's when you have a little firmer ground in terms of what you're advocating for, or of course from the government side, you know, backing up their position. So, yeah. Thank you.
Thank you.
One line from Romans 13, and thank you so much, Rochelle, for both what you had brought to us and also the response to things that are on our mind. Good behavior is not afraid of magistrates. If you want to live without being afraid of authority, you must live honestly. And authority may even honor you. And to follow that up with other words that Paul wrote, or it may lead to death on a cross. We will have our offering right now. Evan will be playing. The basket is on the back. Feel free to get up and put stuff in while he's playing. I really encourage you just to be thinking about the things you've heard and listened to this morning and the questions it's raised in your own mind, and ponder those as music sets a spirit of reflection.
I've got an email from Miranda Borland this week with Family and Child Services, asking if we're sending more money. But anyway, she has stories about the money we did send. I'm writing to let you know about the Jubilee funds we've used for June and July. In June, we helped two families. The mother of three children got a new job and started losing all her benefits because it pays better than not having a job. And so she's trying to get caught up, and we helped with electricity and water. We also helped a family with five children. They were about to lose their place if they didn't get their rent paid. We helped them with June's rent, so they wouldn't have to find a new place for seven people. In July, we helped a single mother who's off work waiting on SSI. She moved into a new place so her teenage daughter could have her own room. We helped her get her back bill to DP&L paid and also get her water turned on. So they've, from what we've given, they've used everything except $362. So that's where our giving is going.